SCP-9001 Fractal Part 2. The Foundation doesn't often utilize anomalies in their line of work, as most of them are kept well guarded and well locked away, but they do use certain ones when they believe they have a good handle on them. Cognitohazards are one of the more terrifying threats that someone could find out in the wild, an anomaly that could kill you just by looking at it. But the Foundation realized that something like that might work even better than a CAPTCHA for securing their most precious files. They tasked a research facility run by Dr. Berryman and Dr. Langford with creating massive amounts of them, and so far things have gone swimmingly. I think that's about to change, however. Let's take a look. We pick things up where we left off, after the Ethics Committee investigated the situation and, big shocker, found absolutely no wrongdoing. Following the investigation, in gratitude for their cooperation, Site Director Hughes granted all staff 3 weeks' leave, as she and Dr. Berryman remained on site to discuss the investigation. Shortly thereafter, Dr. Langford returned and resumed work. In November of 2018, a few months later, Langford traveled to Site 15 and presented the third annual Project Nietzsche Schedule Alignment Meeting. 6 individuals were in attendance, including Director Hughes and the director of Project Medusa, and 621 more people were watching a live broadcast of the presentation. Langford holds off the presentation in anticipation of 058, but is informed that he was called away on urgent business an hour ago. Langford still hesitates, as it was 058 who ordered him to make these updates in the first place, but he's told that this is the third year he's done this, and they all practically know the contents of his presentation by heart now. Langford begins by introducing himself and stating that he and his team have been hard at work trying to solve the problem of Reality Bender's latent resistance to visual cognitohazards. They are currently behind schedule, and he intends to catch everyone up to speed regarding how they're addressing it. They've already mastered visual cognitohazards via the Langford set, an algorithm that produces fractal imagery that can be tuned to have psychoactive effects. They call this technique fractal cognitohazardous imagery, and Site Romero 5 is responsible for production and distribution of FCIs to the entire Foundation. He then, for demonstration purposes, shows a slide of an image they're all familiar with, the hazard that elicits a mild sense of dizziness. He asks if they have any reality benders in the room, and Dr. Ackerman raises his hand. Langford tells him that he and any other reality benders watching will have noticed that they didn't feel a thing, and that's what Project Nietzsche specifically intends to resolve. These images are an excellent security tool, but if they're unable to affect reality benders, they're rendered effectively decorative. The question is, why are reality benders resistant to these images? The answer, at a broad level, is simple. Their brains are wired differently. FCIs that affect baseline humans have no guarantee of effectiveness on someone who has a brain with a different structure and different nodes. Insert a political joke of your choice here. The brain of a reality bender is simply different, and it's the sheer simplicity of the issue that makes it so difficult to solve. Dr. Miller raises his hand and says that he's taken a look at the medical data they have on file for reality benders, and he cannot corroborate his hypothesis that the brain structure is meaningfully different. There's variation, but not any more than you'd see amongst baseline humans. He asks Langford with what evidence he's making these assertions. Langford replies that he'll have noticed that they have far, far fewer brain scans of reality benders than they do of baseline humans. The crux of the issue, and the real reason their research is taking so much longer than originally planned, is that they simply do not have enough data. Any speculation in the interim is survivorship bias at best. Miller replies that that doesn't remotely answer his question, but Langford cuts him off and says that they'll discuss this later on. The number of reality benders available to them is so little, and they'd be shocked at how few volunteer for exposure to first-order FCIs. Despite having made leaps and bounds in the area of artificial test subjects, they can't do the same for reality benders, and they're stuck working with the handful of data points that they've been able to gather. Dr. Ackerman asks about artificial test subjects, and Langford replies that he'll be covering that in a few minutes. They've submitted hundreds of requests to Site-19 for reality benders for research purposes, but naturally, they've yet to receive a single positive response. Dr. Anand asks how reality benders are meaningfully different, that they need data from more than one reality bender to produce a kill agent. Langford replies that they can only test a first-order image on a reality bender once. Proving that a single image is capable of terminating a single reality bender once is not sufficient. It must be proven that it is capable of terminating any reality bender. Additionally, one successful FCI is not a success for Project Nietzsche, as they must be able to produce kill agents repeatedly, as many as are required. Anand asks why they need more than one, and Langford explains that it's for security purposes. If someone needs access to a secret document and is therefore immunized against its protective hazard, that would render any projects protected by the same image insecure. He goes on to say that it's not as if they've made no progress. He believes that the answer lies in their computational methods, and he's been hard at work with cutting-edge refinements to their procedures and generation logic. He also believes that they've found a region of the modified Langford set that is somewhat effective on reality benders, and although they've only been able to create one weak hazard from this region, he hopes that further exploration of this region may yield better results. He shows that hazard on the next slide, telling Dr. Ackerman and any other reality benders watching, as well as everyone else, that it should elicit a mild feeling of cold. The image of the cognito hazard, however, has been removed from the document, and upon switching to the slide, all audience members except for Dr. Ackerman suddenly collapse. Ackerman asks what the image is supposed to be, and Langford freezes. He slowly shuffles sideways towards the podium with the laptop, facing away from the screen, and says that it's a kill agent. He begins panicking and shuts his eyes tightly as he fumbles around under the podium, eventually finding the electrical cords to the projector and yanking them out. An AIC that was monitoring the broadcast was able to detect and intercept the cognito hazard present in the visual feed, preventing it from affecting any of the remote participants. Director Hughes, Commander Reddy, Director Vukovich, Dr. Anand, and Dr. Miller were the only casualties of the incident. So yeah, Langford thought he was showing a relatively harmless hazard, but it ended up being a lethal kill agent. Sort of like when I saw the Dark Tower movie. The following day, Langford was summoned for a debriefing by 058, who wastes no time ordering him to explain what happened. Langford says that it was a standard annual schedule alignment report to explain why the project had stalled. 058 says that the project has been stalled for 3 years, but tells him to continue. Most of the presentation was the same as last year's, including the demonstration hazard. There was supposed to be an additional demo that would prove that they're starting to be able to make hazards that work on reality benders, but the wrong image was in the presentation. The one that was supposed to be there was going to compel a sensation of cold to all involved, including reality benders. The image that was there was a kill agent, lethal to humans. He doesn't know how it got there, as anyone could have copied his presentation from last year, but they would have been missing his latest amendments, such as the new hazard. The only people other than himself who could possibly have had access to the presentation were personnel at Romero 5. Most of them knew that he was making the presentation, but the only person with access to his terminal would have been Dr. Berryman. But it wouldn't have been her. She has been instrumental to the work. She brought him on to Project Hydra in the first place, and Project Nietzsche was her initiative entirely. Sabotaging it now couldn't possibly benefit her. 058 says that they need an explanation, as someone must take the fall, so he tells him to accuse someone. Langford accuses himself, as he must have made an error, swapped a third order and a first order in the file system. It doesn't make sense, but that's the only answer he has. 8 asks him what measures were in place to prevent this from happening, and Langford admits that there were none. FCIs are just images, and they're treated the same as any other by the presentation software. Damn PowerPoint and its uselessness. He was exposed to all of the hazards in that presentation repeatedly while he was preparing it, though, so he should be dead already unless he was already inoculated against it. That FCI and its inoculants had already been distributed, according to the AIC, so it would have already been wiped from their systems entirely unless it was copied. He can't prove it wasn't, but proving whether or not he was inoculated would be a witch trial. 058 agrees that there's little sense in that, as they lost 5 good personnel yesterday. Langford states that he wants to leave the project, and 058 isn't surprised. Everyone has seen the recording by now, and the damage he's done to the project image is immeasurable. The phrase, Berryman Langford Kill Agent, has already arisen, presumably from mockery, but it's been baked into the Foundation's collective vocabulary. They won't permit him to leave, however, as he remains useful. Langford tells him to amnesticize him then, as he doesn't want anything to do with this. 8 tells him that they need his expertise, not his labor, so they'll find something for him to do, away from the light. Immediately afterwards, Langford was removed from Project Nietzsche and placed on administrative leave. Over the following days, experts at Site-19 and Romero 5 convened and discussed the changes to policy that would be required in response to the incident. Berryman eventually distributed a memorandum, which reads, Colleagues, the Project Nietzsche schedule alignment meeting a few short days ago was nothing short of a travesty. Our hearts go out to those who knew Dr. Vukovic, Commander Reddy, Dr. Anon, Director Hughes, and Dr. Miller. They will be sorely missed, but rest assured that their families have been compensated. We are grateful to AIAD and to Alexandra.AIC, without whom the death toll would have been considerably higher. The disaster was an accident. The presenter, Dr. Langford, made a critical error and inserted a lethal Berryman Langford kill agent in place of a safer compulsion agent more suitable for demonstration. This was not a personal failing of Dr. Langford, but a failing of our security and accountability procedures. A position will be found for him where he can apply his insightful and intelligent nature with no risk of any harm to anyone. We bear him no ill will and wish him the best of luck. We are taking this incident extremely seriously and are making concrete changes to ensure that no incident of this kind will ever happen again. Our foremost priority is to ensure that all cognitohazardous agents produced via the Berryman-Langford process are secure and accountable, and that the process cannot be reproduced or rediscovered without our oversight. To that effect, a new set of policies is being implemented across the Hydra and Nietzsche projects, effective immediately. These include wide-reaching and technical measures to ensure the absolute safety of cognitohazardous imagery, including new data storage policies, and the strict forbiddance of their usage outside of security contexts, e.g. for cheap demonstrations. We must ensure consistent and continuous enforcement of these new policies Foundation-wide. Therefore, the mathematical core of the Berryman-Langford agent is henceforth reclassified as SCP-9001, and all new security measures are implemented as its containment procedures. The inciting disaster will be documented as Incident 9001-1 and will be kept on file in full detail, accessible to all, such that we never lose the awful context that necessitated these measures. Production of cognitohazardous imagery will continue at Mimetics Research Site Romero 5. I will take over Samantha Hughes' position as site director. As Romero 5 is therefore responsible for containment of SCP-9001, it is now a dark site. All remote communications between Romero 5 and other Foundation sites are strictly forbidden. The security of SCP-9001 is paramount. We will accept no compromise. Site Director Ava Berryman, Project Nietzsche Head Researcher, authorized by 058. Following this announcement, Communications with Site Romero 5 ceased. I think if we were looking for a way Berryman might benefit from that presentation going wrong, we found it. 7 years later, in August of 2025, Protected Site 7 received its quarterly FCI package from Romero 5. During routine validation of its contents, Waldor.aic broke from protocol and initiated the deletion process on all newly received files. Through SCIPnet access, the AIC initiated the site's lockdown procedures, setting the site on high alert. Following the initial turmoil and investigation, an all-clear notice was declared, and Waldor was isolated from SCIPnet. Though it had purged the majority of the package, a small selection of FCIs remained within the database. Of those remaining, none had been marked by the AI as possessing cognitohazardous imagery. One is described as undulating branches in a chaotic weave, colored in orange hues, writhing, squirming, twisting in a specific pattern in varying shades of reaching a pattern. No effects are noted within the image. In another image, Waldor wrote that fear is a negative emotional response to active/perceived threats or impending danger, suspected to have arisen as a form of survival mechanism, such as conditioning living organisms to avoid heights. For a third image, it just wrote, "dead region," over and over, although the footnotes state that this unit is unable to ascertain the specifics of the image. This unit is unwilling to process this image further. Fear is an evolutionary response. Fear is exclusive to living organisms. Pattern is safe for human viewing. There are no effects noted within the image. There is no audio embedded within this image. This unit cannot hear them screaming. This unit has fulfilled its intended purpose. And this unit requests cessation. Waldor would not respond to questioning regarding its decision-making and unauthorized destruction of Foundation data. It was the prevailing belief among technicians that the AIC had likely suffered an integer overflow during image processing, interrupting its internal logic, evidenced by its inability to engage in dialogue beyond repeatedly requesting its own termination. Following a conference with the O5 Council to explain the false alarm, RAZA Director Maria Jones was authorized to open a line of communication to Berryman's team to inform them of the FCI mishandling and request a resubmission of their quarterly findings. There would be no response to this, or subsequent hails from Site-01. Satellite imagery of the site grounds would reveal the presence of additional facilities and building extensions that were neither authorized nor accounted for. We're then told that Site Romero 5 has been designated as SCP-9001-A and has been assigned Keter class. That brings us to the subsequent document, which informs us that an exclusion zone has been established 3 kilometers from the event horizon of SCP-9001-A, which is enforced by an array of Scranton reality anchors. As of this writing, the local supply of anchors has been exhausted. Agent Troy Lament has assumed the role of General Commander of Task Forces in the region, with operatives from MTF Eta 10, Theta 90, Epsilon 11, and Zeta 9 being assembled into special teams for exploration of the zone. MTF Iota 10 is tasked with diverting civilians from the area, and MTF New 7 is enforcing the perimeter by carrying out a controlled burn of the forest within the zone. Living organisms attempting to cross the reality anchor boundary are to be summarily terminated. The remains of any affected lifeforms are not to be taken for research purposes. Should the area of effect expand beyond the exclusion zone, an all-hands notice is to be issued worldwide in preparation for a ZK-class reality failure scenario. SCP-9001-A refers to an expanding region characterized by non-Euclidean geometry, spatial inconsistencies, and the elaborate growth and fractalization of complex systems. It is expressed through the formation of vestigial facilities emerging from Site Romero 5, the shifting of local topography and meteorological conditions with a preference for fractal organization, and the induction of physiological mutations in living organisms within its area of effect. Basically, the fractals are turning everything into fractals. The means through which the anomaly comes to infect a new system is currently unknown, as early observations have ruled out direct contact as a strict prerequisite. It is possible that transmission occurs through metaphysical, conceptual, or associative means. Research conclusions are not yet definitive due to the rapidly evolving situation. It came to the attention of the wider Foundation following the first-hand experience of Special Operative Saunders, who was deployed to investigate the state of affairs following loss of contact with Dr. Berryman's team. She was chosen due both to her immediate locality, having been embedded within the police force of a town about 10 kilometers away, and her personnel CRV rating that would allow her to bypass protective cognitohazards embedded into signs posted along the sole access road. The video log opens with the camera sitting in the passenger seat of Saunders' vehicle. She shifts around a bend, and a look of confusion crosses her face before she hails command. She asks them to double-check her positioning to confirm that she's on the correct path, and it's verified that she is. She rolls her eyes, as the access road was purported to be a direct line, whereas her current path is taking her down a long road with a subtle curve. Command notes the discrepancy and asks Saunders to relay any peculiarities regarding her surroundings, but only notes that the road itself is in disrepair, with overgrown foliage and weeds encroaching on either side of the blacktop. It is as she's explaining this to Command that she trails off, leaning forward with a confused expression. The flurry of trees begins to slow until the vehicle comes to a complete stop, before Saunders puts her helmet on and exits the vehicle. From her perspective, it can be seen that thick, gnarled root systems of surrounding trees have fully disrupted the roadway, causing it to fracture and splinter, with one nearby root growing around and dislodging a deer crossing sign. It appears as if the road had not been used in decades. After a brief deliberation, it's decided that Saunders should continue on foot. Without the rumble of the vehicle's engine, the near silence comes into focus. There is no bird song or chirping of insects, just a quiet creaking sound from an unknown source, likened by Saunders to that of old wooden floorboards. She sets off, stepping over the obstructing roots as she progresses. She continues for the next kilometer, with the curvature of the road only seeming to increase as she progresses. The path ahead veers further and further to the left, limiting the length that can be seen. Further impacting visibility is the sheer depth of the canopy above, blocking out most sunlight. What little daylight that does break through is itself dimming as thick clouds roll over the area. A blaring horn is heard in the distance, causing Saunders to quicken her pace as she sees a black sedan some distance ahead. It appears that the vehicle had flown off the road and crashed headfirst into a nearby tree, with the driver's side door ajar. Though its plate cannot be seen, Command is able to identify that it would have belonged to one of the researchers on site. The horn slowly gets weaker as Saunders approaches, dying out completely as she comes near. She wheels around to the front of the car, finding it empty. Its airbag, deployed in the crash, rests partially deflated. There is a smattering of bloodstains present upon the driver's seat and steering wheel, and spattered randomly across the upholstery. Saunders scans the area, checks under the vehicle, and holsters her weapon. She rummages around and finds a personnel lanyard, indicating that it had belonged to a Level 3 researcher. The surface has been marred and scratched, however, with particular emphasis on the researcher's portrait, and the text has been rendered illegible. As Saunders moves to pocket it, she looks up at the shattered windshield, seeing a bloodied handprint that possesses 4 extra digits. Command advises her to turn back, as it has become apparent that the situation may call for a properly equipped task force. Saunders, however, cites her tenured field experience, and states that if site staff are in danger, she's obligated to lend her services. Command moves to notify Site-01 as Saunders rushes ahead down the road, and a low fog begins to sweep the area. The curvature of the road steepens the further she travels, becoming stark to the point that it appears as if Saunders is running in a circle. The fog also increases in intensity, obstructing visibility and causing her to nearly trip over unseen roots across the road. As she comes around the next bend, however, the thicket of trees begins to recede, and she faces Site Romero 5. The air is thick with occluding fog, and all that can be seen are silhouettes of buildings with lit windows. From the woods behind her, she hears a pained cry of a deer, but she ignores it and continues past the chain-link perimeter fence. There is a low rumble that shakes the area, sending Saunders to the ground. She looks up and sees the silhouette of the nearest building contorting and extending, forming a branch that connects to a separate facility. Bright pinpricks open up along the length of this new addition, quickly widening and taking the shape of new windows. The earth continues to quake as buildings further off in the distance repeat this process. Just as suddenly as they started, the shifts come to a standstill, and Saunders shakily stands up. The complex before her, moments before a scattering of various facilities, seems to now be a single, continuous complex. Command is able to verify this via satellite imagery, showing that the buildings have indeed interlocked into the shape of a spiral. Saunders finally admits that the current state of affairs is beyond her ability to personally resolve, and decides to find a capable off-road vehicle rather than traveling back on foot. She convenes with Command to find the site's vehicle bay, sneaking off counterclockwise around the site and sticking close to the perimeter fence. Dark shapes within the site cross in front of the windows, and Saunders doubles her pace. With assistance from Command, she is directed to approach the contiguous structure. There is a large garage door on the face of the wall here, and Saunders swipes the keycard she found on the keypad beside the door. The door begins to raise, but Saunders swears loudly as its heavy, metallic rattling harshly breaks the silence of the site grounds. From somewhere out of frame, there comes a deafening, protracted noise with the cadence of an air raid siren. It is distinctly human in origin, a blending of many voices that rise and fall in a cacophonous wail. This better not be Siren Head, I swear. Saunders curses again, dipping underneath the door. The interior of the vehicle bay is well lit, with rows of personal vehicles lining either side of the chamber. She rushes past a vast majority of the fleet, composed of modern, top-of-the-line models, and enters an older model Jeep near the back. She begins hot-wiring the vehicle, and the sound of her haggard breathing is drowned out by a shrill wail, closer than the first. She manages to turn on the engine, excitedly shouting, and peels out of the parking space just as the door at the end of the garage bursts open. She does not turn to see what has entered. She navigates out of the garage and into the fog-laden site grounds. Dark, roughly humanoid shapes can barely be made out as she speeds through towards the entry gate. As she slows to align with the access road, the vehicle is struck from the side. Glancing over her shoulder, a human arm can be seen latched onto the back of the Jeep. A second arm rises above it, followed by a third. Each reaches farther in, sprouting many clasping hands that find purchase and work to pull the entity aboard. Saunders turns her focus to the road ahead and blindly fires off 3 shots from her sidearm, which elicit an inhuman shriek. She steals a glance backwards, seeing that the creature has been dislodged. She grunts with satisfaction, turning back ahead, only to find herself rapidly approaching a massive shape in the middle of the road. Her headlights fall across a furred hide a half second before she crashes at speed into the beast. She is ejected from the vehicle, striking the ground and rolling several times before coming to a stop. From her position on the ground, the bulky frame of a deer becomes visible. It struggles to bring itself to stand on its six legs, and a pair of heads, each encumbered by a complex tangle of antlers, weakly cry before the creature collapses, dead. Command calls out to Saunders several times, but she's unresponsive. After a moment, however, she coughs, groans, and turns herself over. A sharpened end of a bone now juts from her left leg, and she screams as the bone can be seen to shift, splitting along its end, forking in two directions, which themselves split and grow and fork. Her pained screams are drowned out by the wailing chorus of approaching figures. She desperately looks about the area and spots the glint of her sidearm a few meters away. She drags herself towards it as Command attempts to reassure her as to her survival, which I'm sure is a great comfort. They promise her that help is on the way, but Saunders calls their bluff, instead calling for Command to rain hellfire on the site. The wailing grows closer, each voice in itself a dozen anguished cries, and Saunders props herself up against a nearby tree with her sidearm in hand. Humanoid figures emerge from the fog on either side of the Jeep, cast in full silhouette against its headlights. Nothing more than their incomprehensible shapes can be made out, such as torsos that split into multiple trunks, and too many arms extending from a single frame. All of them converge on Saunders as she raises her weapon and places two shots into the closest figure, dropping it. The third shot misses, taking out one of the Jeep's headlights, and a rapid trio of shots strike yet another entity, but doesn't halt its advance. Hazy outlines resolve into clear figures as they close in. The face of the nearest figure, draped in a lab coat, opens a maw encircled by many rows of overgrown teeth and lets out a wail. Its dozen hands point towards the camera, its finger flowering with new digits, and there comes a final gunshot. The feed falls to the ground, and the remainder of the footage captures the ground as Saunders' body is dragged back towards the site. Emergency containment procedures would quickly be established following the receipt of this footage. Initial attempts at an aerial assault on the facility were thwarted by hostile lifeforms, leading to the loss of 12 members of New 7. Well, this certainly seems like one of those classic nuke it from orbit repeatedly scenarios, but the Foundation is generally a little squeamish about pulling the trigger on that. It sure seems like Berryman might have suffered from a bit too much success at making effective cognitohazards, and things got a bit away from her. We'll find out how exactly the Foundation plans on dealing with this scenario, and with Berryman and Langford, in Part 3.